Hello. On this week's program, Bucks County artist Susan Opie walks us through her exhibition, Works of Bugs and Critters, now at the Michener Art Museum in Doylestown. Jason Pfeiffer takes a look at the life and work of the late Wendy Wasserstein, whose last play, Third, is being produced by the Philadelphia Theatre Company. The hippest new computer consoles use musical instruments as player interfaces, but the classical world is now in on the game. We talk to Minnesota Orchestra assistant conductor Sarah Hatsuko Hicks about Virtual Maestro. And Susan Lewis looks at Philadelphia's Ballet X and its upcoming premiere of Matthew Neenan's Right to Spring. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Our first item this morning takes us to a rather windswept Doylestown and the James A. Michener Art Museum Sculpture Garden for an exhibition of Works of Bugs and Critters by the Bucks County artist Susan Opie. Susan Opie's been working in bronze and bronze alloys since 1980, when she built her own foundry at her farm, and she's with me now. So are the works in this exhibition site-specific, or is it just a sampling of your output?
These are not site-specific. This is a sampling. Some of these were at the Allentown Art Museum 2 years ago, and some of them are new pieces. I didn't want to just repeat the same show. None of these are commissions. I choose what I want to do, and right now, obviously, it's big insects.
Why?
Well, I think dogs, cats, and horses have been well done. I wanted to present something that's less often seen. I like the shapes that insects come up with. They're very exotic, almost alien.
And what was your starting point with these? Were you using live models, or was it from photos or from your imagination?
Both. I'm out in the country, and as you know, I see my share of ticks and praying mantises and other local insects, but I also look at entomology books. But it goes back to when I was a kid and on a farm, and I turned over rocks and collected spiders for pets. Maybe a strange childhood.
Surprisingly, for their size, there isn't a sense of them being very creepy.
They're not creepy. I have done some creepy ones, and people say yuck, and as my husband says, you'll never sell a human head louse.
Or a tick.
Well, I've done a tick also. I've done a flea. They're sitting at home. People like praying mantises, butterflies, not mosquitoes.
And so what you've presented here is, right in front of us, is that is a praying mantis?
There is a praying mantis, a small one on the tower. This one is a Mormon cricket, which is the insect that tried to wipe out Salt Lake City. You know that story?
No, I don't.
Well, there was a plague of, I think they're not crickets, I think maybe they're locusts. They moved into Salt Lake City and ate everything in sight, and then seagulls showed up unexpectedly and made a meal out of the bugs, and Salt Lake City has erected monuments to the seagulls. But I have a monument to the other end of that story, the bug.
I'm correct in saying that these are copper and well-weathered copper.
They're not copper. They're a copper alloy. They're bronze, and it's called silicon bronze. It's a rather new alloy, and it was developed to be resistant to corrosion. So chains for naval ships, are made out of silicon bronze because the salt water doesn't corrode it.
And these have lived outside they've been created.
Yes, and they can be outside forever. It's a hard material to work with, but artists use it because it pours very liquid and you get every little detail. And it's what most art bronzes are made from now.
And when you're pouring it, does it have this greenish hue to it, or is it a golden?
When it's poured, it looks like orange juice. It gives off energy. It's very beautiful. These are helped chemically with their patinas. Over time, they would patina themselves, but it's had a little help in the beginning here.
And when you're starting, what form are you sculpting in? Are you working in clay? What's your starting point?
This is a lost wax process, and I model directly in wax. A lot of artists do it in plaster or, you know, clay or some other material, but I do it directly in the wax. Then it goes into the mold-making process, and it's a ceramic shell mold material.
And then are you upscaling from your original sculpture?
No, I have small versions. I don't draw much. I can draw. I don't draw much. I don't make small models. These spring right from my head pretty much as I want them. I have it in my head and can make it directly.
Is this part of a much larger collection of insects?
Yes.
How big?
Oh, a barn full at home.
And how long have you been, I mean, have you been focused on insects for a period of time?
No, I've changed subject matter. And I want to leave insects, but I keep getting pulled back in. Somebody will ask for one, or there's something that has to be finished. And also, it's not that different from insects, but there's also a lizard piece over there.
Who prey on insects.
Yes.
I note that the what these are sitting on some they're sitting on, are these your rocks, or are they local? Or
yes, they're local. We drag them down here. There's a red shale, like that large piece, which comes from my farm. It's not a very good material because it does fracture. And then I took some of the other chunks off a friend's farm, and we just brought them down. It makes a nice base for them. It moves them up off the ground. While I'm working on these pieces, they seem large to me, but when you get them outside, they don't look so large anymore. And the rocks, I think, are an attractive material in themselves, so it's a good marriage.
And some of the others are standing rather unnaturally, I would say, on towers,
yeah,
steel
there
towers.
Yeah, towers. And they're bronze towers. I buy those rods. It's silicon bronze. It's an alloy that matches what I cast with. So when they're patinaed, it all comes out the same color. And obviously, the towers involve a lot of welding.
You say that when you bring these sculptures out into the oven, that they always look smaller. Mm-hmm. What was your view of when you first saw this exhibition installed in this sculpture garden?
I thought this was a nice space, and they look good here. And they're natural, out in the natural setting. It's going to look better when the trees blossom out. This is a very attractive setting for them. I'm very pleased with them here.
So if nobody's going to come to you and beg for insects again, mm-hmm. is it then reptiles, or is that just
just another subject matter. I do figures also. I don't do anything abstract, except the towers are an abstract concept, so those are kind of a marriage between abstract and figurative. I call these insects figurative. People think of figurative as human figures, but of course we're not the only animals in the world.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sculptor Susan Opie. Her Works of Bugs and Critters is at the James Michener Art Museum in Doylestown through June 22nd.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
When Wendy Wasserstein died in early 2006, the theater world lost one of its most prominent playwrights. Wasserstein's 1988 Heidi Chronicles was among her best-known plays, winning a Pulitzer Prize and a Tony Award, the first given to a female playwright for Best Play. This week, the Philadelphia Theatre Company opens Wasserstein's final work, Third. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, this 2005 comedy capped off the career of a writer whose work was often praised for its humour and fresh perspective.
Gail Sisiola, an English professor at Villanova University, recalls in the late 1980s when she went to see the Heidi Chronicles for the first time in New York.
And I remember when I walked out of the theater that night that I felt that my life had been profoundly changed. And the reason for that was that I felt that I had just seen a play about a character to whom I could fully relate.
Sisiola wrote a 1998 book about Wasserstein called Wendy Wasserstein, Dramatizing Women, Their Choices, and Their Boundaries. She says that, like her own experience, the playwright's body of work had a similar effect on countless other women. This sort of empathy helped fuel the popularity of Wasserstein's work. A Brooklyn native, Wendy Wasserstein wrote essays, screenplays, and even a children's book. But she was first and foremost a theater person. Starting with her breakout 1977 play, Uncommon Women and Others, Gail Sasiola explains that Wasserstein uniquely explored the private lives of women who came of age during the women's movement of the 1960s and 70s.
When we examine what she has done against, say, what other women playwrights have done, she really is the only one who has devoted almost an entire oeuvre just to the question of what were our lives like in the last quarter of the 20th century and going into the 21st century.
She really, in a very penetrating way, got at what it means to be a woman grappling with issues of work and relationships.
Mary Robinson, who directs the Philadelphia Theater Company production of Third, says Wasserstein didn't do this, however, in a didactic way. And Gail Sasiola points out that Wasserstein always made it clear that she did not speak for every woman in her writing. Rather, she created characters who were very much like herself, urban, middle class, well-educated, and in pursuit of a career, like Laurie Jameson in Third.
Excuse me, Professor Jameson, can I talk to you for a second?
Sure. How can I help you, Mr.?
Bull. Woodson Bull.
You're kidding.
No, ma'am.
Oh, you don't have to call me ma'am. This isn't the Citadel.
Lisbeth McKay plays the central character of Third, Laurie Jameson, a 54-year-old professor at an elite New England college, who finds her long-held liberal convictions challenged by a student, Woodson Bull, played by Will Fowler. The title of the play is in one sense a reference to this student, Woodson Bull III, but it also alludes to the approach of what is sometimes called the third act of life, the first act being the years of youth, the second act the middle age years, and the third act the later part of life. The play mirrors Wasserstein's own stage of life when she was writing Third as a 55-year-old. In fact, the sum of her plays in many ways chronicles the life stages of her generation, from being a college graduate in the early 70s to building a career in the 80s and 90s to grappling with what it means to be middle-aged now. Playwright Christopher Durang was a longtime friend of Wasserstein and is the co-executor of her literary estate. He says many of her works are rather nakedly autobiographical.
Knowing her well, it took some getting used to, almost, how personal her plays would be, that you would sort of look at some of her plays and go, oh, that's the Wendy figure.
However, Durang notes that contrary to how many people tend to interpret the play, he does not consider Third's main character, Laurie Jameson, to be a Wendy figure. Yet the humor found in Third is undoubtedly Wasserstein. Durang says her sharp wit and comic sensibility, both in real life and in her writing, are part of what made her so successful. But beneath the comedy, Third director Mary Robinson says there is always great depth of insight and socially conscious material.
That's what's so terrific about her writing, is that she balances what's on her mind and what she wants to explore and express with just completely unique humor.
Robinson says while Wasserstein plays are noted for having a very female perspective, the protagonists are almost always women, her pieces still manage to have a broad appeal. Christopher Durang says she wasn't just writing about women's issues.
Men and women are both human beings, writing about human beings. And I know in her later years, she used to sometimes amend. When people would say, are you a feminist writer? She would say, I think of myself as a humanist writer. And I think I always felt of her that way.
Along with audiences, actors also treasure the plays of Wasserstein. Lisbeth McKay, who plays Laurie Jameson in Third and was a classmate of Wasserstein at the Yale School of Drama, says the characters Wasserstein created in different stages of life are very coveted roles.
With her death, one of the things all actresses mourned is that we don't get to have a play now about women in their 60s, you know, and in their 70s and in their 80s that Wendy certainly would have written, and we will miss that. It's a great, great loss.
This past January marked 2 years since Wendy Wasserstein's death from lymphoma. Third premiered in New York only months before she passed away. Though her health was in decline as she was finishing writing the play, Wasserstein continued to work diligently on her final comedy through rehearsals and previews all the way to opening night, a testament to her dedication and love for her art. In commemoration of Wasserstein's life, influence, and works, the Philadelphia Theater Company will augment their production of Third with a series of panels and readings of other Wasserstein plays throughout the show's run.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Third is at the Philadelphia Theater Company's Suzanne Roberts Theater through April 20th. The latest new trend in home video game consoles has players wielding replica electric guitars as they simulate the playing of rock music. Games like Guitar Hero and Rock Band allow players to act out their rock star fantasies. But the concept is nothing new in the classical music world. Virtual Maestro, an interactive installation developed over a year ago by the Philadelphia Orchestra's season sponsor, UBS, gives audience members a chance to simulate the experience of conducting a great orchestra. It's now installed at the Kimmel Center, having already been put through its paces at Orchestra Hall in Minneapolis, where Minnesota Orchestra assistant conductor Sarah Hatsuko Hicks gave it a try. We spoke to her on the line from Orchestra Hall. The impression I have is that the Virtual Maestro looks like something akin to a computer or an arcade game. Is that a fair description?
I guess it's more like a Wii, if you've ever played those, where there's a wand that picks up your arm gestures that then affects what's happening on the screen, if that makes any sense. I guess it is kind of like a computer or a video game.
And the interface then is, as you say, a wand.
Yes.
Nothing attached to your eyes, so you can't sort of glare at these virtual musicians.
Well, that would really duplicate the true conducting process. But really, it's just the implement in the hand that you wave, and you can really affect the tempo of what's happening. And it's very immediate.
As distinct from working with humans, where you allow for a certain delay before they respond.
There's a little bit of lapse for humans. I mean, I think the synapses have to fire, and then that has to translate to the arm movement. So you get that little bit of delay, but this was unnervingly immediate.
And it also controls volume. Are there any other parts of the music that you can influence with your hands?
That's really it. I think the idea is to have that sort of feeling of being in control of all of the sound, and just a gesture can completely change the rate of movement, which I think for people is difficult to understand unless they actually try it.
You've actually walked out of the concert hall having conducted real live musicians, and then gone and conducted using the Virtual Maestro. How were the two experiences different, or was it immediately obvious that you were dealing with something mechanical?
Well, again, it's because the reaction time is so quick. And of course, I was trying to exaggerate the tempo changes. So it was completely unnatural and very unmusical what I was doing with the Virtual Maestro. But it's just so immediate. And so there's not that organic sense that you get from working with people. And it's missing that one thing that is intangible, really, where the conductor also reacts to what they hear. And you can't really do that with the Virtual Maestro. It's a little bit different from working with people.
What's the sound like?
It's the same every time you play it, because it's the same recording they're working on, which again is different from working with human beings who will produce something different every time you do something. So, a little bit of a different experience, but again, interesting just for the layperson to, get the feel of what it is to be up on a podium and needing to guide people who will immediately react to you.
What's been the reaction of audiences there to this machine, to the people who've actually used it, who had no prior conducting experience?
I've seen people get up and sort of look completely baffled for about a minute, and then understand the swing of things and the look of sheer delight that comes across their face, that their gesture is being translated into sound on a screen. It's kind of extraordinary to watch that process.
And have any of them then, I don't know, in the aftermath of that, been applying for your job, or has anybody decided that there might be a career in conducting for them after using the Virtual Maestro?
Gosh, I would hope not. Our career field is cluttered as it is. But I've certainly had some people come up to me and want to chat to me further about what it is to be a conductor. And it just really sparked their interest. We had a couple of younger people do it, too. And it was nice to see that look of exploration and interest on their face, and just sort of being there in front of an orchestra, and what a wonderful experience that is.
So it could potentially, all joking aside, spur somebody to take an interest in conducting at a very basic level.
I think so. It could really sort of put you in that mind frame and say, huh, this is interesting stuff.
Minnesota Orchestra assistant conductor Sarah Hatsuko Hicks. The UBS Virtual Maestro is in Commonwealth Plaza at the Kimmel Center until April 15th. Winter wrapped up this week, at least on the calendar. And in recent years, like the flowers now blooming in gardens throughout the region, Philadelphia's dance scene has blossomed, with dance companies of all sorts, sizes, and cultural traditions, from classical ballet and jazz to hip-hop, flamenco, and even Irish step dancing. Modern dance is by now a well-established form, while contemporary dance is an eclectic mix of innovation and tradition. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at a contemporary ballet troupe whose new, timely work is called Right to Spring.
To some people, Ballet means lithe young women in tutus gracefully moving to classical music or leaping into the well-toned arms of young men.
The old ballet audiences wanted to go and see Sleeping Beauty in Romeo and Juliet or something. That's what they really wanted to see.
Terry Fox is director of Philadelphia Dance Projects, a professional development group for dance artists.
And then Balanchine started doing sort of abstract works. And then dancers started getting on the floor, and not because they were dying swans, you know.
Somewhere beyond the old school traditional ballet, but in a realm apart from gravity-friendly modern dance, lies contemporary ballet. This is the focus of a company founded by former Pennsylvania ballet dancers Matthew Neenan and Christine Cox to experiment with the form. They call it Ballet X.
I love the idea of the X. It could mean ballet expression, exposure, existence.
X generation, explore, ballet with a... For some people it might mean we're straying from ballet, even though we're not.
Contemporary ballet is rooted in the technique of the classical form.
Ballet, it has a science to it and a technique that we still use and that will never die. But with any art or with any sport, it evolves. Now ballet can be sexy, it can be edgy, it can be intimate.
Ballet X aims to be all of those things. Now, in its first season as resident dance company at the Wilma Theater, it's premiering Neenan's Right to Spring, which references, but should not be confused with, the famous early 20th century work.
At first, we thought we might do a takeoff of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. I even thought I might use some of that music. And I was listening to the music. I'm like, it's great music, but it's not me.
But like Stravinsky's work when it opened, Rite to Spring also challenges convention. An abstract story about the emotional transition from winter to spring, the ballet is danced in part to the music of Mozart, but mostly to original music composed and played live by Matthew Pierce. This, with a minimalist set consisting of images projected onto screens, designed by sculptor and installation artist Stephen Earle Weber. This is not the way company choreographer Matthew Neenan typically works. He generally begins with existing music.
I become obsessed with the music, and I listen to it day in and day out. And then by the time I start creating it in the studio, it's like second nature.
This collaboration involved more give and take as each artistic element developed. For example, with guidance from Neenan, Matthew Pierce began creating music. Neenan, in turn, reacted, piece by piece, deciding what music to use when, or if at all.
Some of his music, too, would start off with a really nice melody for dance, but then it would get really rock. The drums and the guitars would come in, and I was like, oh, you know, like, that's great, but for dance, we kind of need to stay in this genre. And it's about the dance.
Staying within the genre was also a challenge for sculptor and installation artist Stephen Earle Weber.
The background that I'm working on is just that. It's a background. So sometimes I have to tone it down, slow it down, make sure that it doesn't overtake the image of the dancers. My job is to help reinforce what Maddie's trying to do.
Weber sought to find images for projections that would avoid cliches. One idea came to him over a drink with Matthew Neenan.
And I was looking at the condensation inside of the drink and the ice in the drink. I said, what if we zeroed in on something like that, on a close-up, and filled the frame with that?
Working with video artist David Kessler, Weber filled large jars with ice and water, then turned on lights and started the camera rolling.
So it gives this sort of slow, liquidy movement of ice and the condensation, and it slowly settles. And it will look very still for a long time until the temperature changes, and then it sort of clunk and moves. With each piece of music throughout the program, the images change. They also change with the intensity of the music. Sometimes the light will get brighter, it'll get dimmer, it'll be colder, warmer.
Pennsylvania ballet dancer Martha Chamberlain created the costumes, which also counter cliches and upend expectations, says Matthew Neenan.
In this piece, we actually put more clothes on as we get into spring. We kind of start out a little more naked, chilly looking, and then as the piece goes on, we come in with normal wear, like pants and shirts, girls in dresses, almost like Easter attire. We become more human in the springtime.
Everything comes together around the choreography, which is, of course, the point. On point or not, Ninin's contemporary ballet takes classical dance and turns it, so to speak, into his own style of movement, says his Ballet X co-founder, Christine Cox.
So, for instance, the dancers may have their arms extended out in like a V, and then they just simply bend one elbow, and then they cramp everything in to this very distorted. So you're going from these really long, lengthy lines to very contracted and short images in snap seconds, all in unison.
In Right to Spring, Cox dances, as does Ninin. Cox, who first came up with the idea of exploring the transition from winter to spring, says her part in this ballet is as a symbol of change.
There's a moment in between the end of winter and the beginning of spring, when I come out and you hear wind. And I'm blown on. I do this long, slow transition with another dancer, my partner through life. And in the end, I unveil and I'm in the next scene, and out come the other women, and then I dance with them in spring. I think one of my dresses comes off and I'm in color and we're in light.
Out of the darkness of winter comes color and light in this abstract story of new beginnings from a company in the midst of its own fresh start in its first season at the Wilma Theater, and by now, a perennial on the city's rapidly blooming dance landscape.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Ballet X production of Matthew Ninin's Right to Spring premieres this Wednesday at the Wilma Theatre in Philadelphia and runs through Sunday, March 30th. That's our program. Our thanks this week to Debbie Fleischman, Inna Lobanova-Heasley, Lauren Saul, Catherine Blodgett, and Kerry Smudridge. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.